going to go on to case number 5, which is 103214. It's Eaton versus the Indiana Department of Corrections. So come on up. Good morning, Mr. Hent.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Do you need some water?
I think I'm okay.
I think you need some water.
Water.
No, don't start the time.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
No, don't worry about it.
May it please the court, my name is David Henn. On behalf of Autumn Eaton, Ms. Eaton appeals the entry of summary judgment in her case brought under Title VII, alleging age gender discrimination. The court will note that her claims under the Family Medical Leave Act, as well as the Disability Discrimination Act, were waived as part of summary judgment proceedings.
Can I just ask you this? What was Ms. Eaton's disciplinary history different from that of Mr. Curtis in the sense that the entirety of her history is related to not showing up at work or training, so that when she refused an assignment, the prison might have said, that's it, you know, we're tired of this?
No, Your Honor. I don't think it's accurate. It's been characterized all through this as a disciplinary history of absenteeism. The record will show in her deposition, which I think is docket number 49-1, she never took time from work that she didn't have. It was all sick leave or vacation leave or Family Medical Leave Act leave. And so if she wasn't using her given vacation or sick leave, then she was not at work with the Department of Corrections approval. And so to call that discipline, to call that absenteeism, yeah, she's not there. Could that create a staffing problem? Yes, that's true. And would the Department of Corrections be able to step up and say, you know what, you can't take that vacation because we need you here, or something like that? But I don't want to call that a disciplinary record. So if you look at it, if we look at what she has as vacation time and sick time and FMLA time, if we remove that disciplinary history from her, then what we have is she missed this training episode or mandatory training session. Now, is that a moment of absenteeism? Well, the record's devoid of what that was. Was she on station and didn't leave her post to go to training? Or did she not come in for a special training session? She explained in her deposition that was a miscommunication and that she didn't realize what was going on, but she thought it was taken care of in her own words. But yes, we do have that disciplinary history of not showing up at a mandatory training session, which I would not characterize as absenteeism. I would characterize as failure to follow the direction of a supervisor. She was told, you must come to this training session, and she didn't. Now, I would compare that, too, directly to Mr. Curtis, who has a prior disciplinary history of not following what his supervisor told him when they said, turn off the television while you're on station or while you're working, turn off the TV, and he didn't. Both of them didn't follow a direct order of a supervisor.
Do I understand correctly that, putting aside summary judgment, if the case had gone on beyond that, there was an issue as to whether she was actually fired or not, that the Department of Corrections takes the view that she quit rather than being fired?
Yes.
Where do we get all these justifications for why she was fired?
Well, on appeal, Department of Corrections has conceded that there's a question of fact here about whether she was in fact fired or quit. But really, when you look at the moment of her wrongful separation, I'm going to use that word, wrongful separation from the Department of Corrections, it's when she was told, you can't come back.
How many hours was that after she left, after she picked up and left the facility that day?
It was within a couple of hours that Officer Neal, who happened to be her mother, called or was told by Lieutenant Bensheimer that she would not be permitted to return. So originally, you have her supervisor sending her home because she's too upset with the expectation that she'll come back to work her next scheduled date. Then within a couple of hours, for something happened, he changed his mind and said, she can't come back to work now. And an order is sent to the gate saying she is now has a gate closure or the facility would no longer let her in.
That's in the record?
That is in the record.
Okay.
That is correct. You'll find that in Ms. Eaton's affidavit,
okay,
as well as in Ms. Officer Neal's affidavit as well.
We don't have the document. We have statements in the affidavits.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Now, when you really look at the moment at which she is separated from employment, it's when she's not allowed to come back. Now, you compare that to Mr. Curtis. He actually quit when he refused to go to the assignment that his supervisor sent him to. He quit and left the facility cussing and swearing. We have that affidavit testimony in the record. And yet, a couple of hours later, 45 minutes perhaps, I think is what his affidavit said, he changed his mind, came back, and the same supervisor that denied Ms. Eaton reentry allowed him to come back on. Now, that is a critical moment in time because they are almost completely identical as far as our strive to find a comparator employee that's substantially similar. At that moment in time, they're almost completely identical, or Mr. Curtis is actually in a worse position because he quit and left without permission. Ms. Eaton, yes, ma'am.
So essentially, as I understand your argument, you think the first problem in the district court's opinion is with the prima facie case that her job performance was meeting the department's legitimate expectations by the time you actually correctly categorize these various days when she wasn't there and realized that it was sick leave or FMLA, et cetera, and that Mr. Curtis is a valid comparator given all the things you're talking about. I don't think anybody's complaining at the moment about one or three. And that their legitimate non-discriminatory reason, you have a bad record, is pretext for, given the nature of what had actually happened. Am I correctly summarizing your case? Because that's why you think she needs, so that would mean a jury would have to decide what was the real reason.
That is correct.
Yeah.
One thing I would add, Your Honor, I don't believe the district court made a specific finding as to whether she was satisfactorily performing her job, because the district court focused upon the comparator employee issue.
Right, but I suppose, looking at the record, she gets a number of commendations even after some of the absences. She gets a letter of appreciation, for instance, on December 5th, 2007, which is after some of these things have happened.
That is correct.
So your position, I assume, is that there's enough evidence in the record that a rational person could think she is meeting expectations.
Absolutely. And actually, the Department of Corrections, in its brief, agrees there is a genuine issue of fact on that as well.
How much of her prior discipline for excessive absenteeism do you believe was related to her use of FMLA time?
I don't believe any, Your Honor. I'm not sure.
Do they call it discipline when it was FMLA or sick leave?
What? I thought that was one of your arguments.
No,
you were at least arguing that she shouldn't have the FMLA time held against her.
Right.
Maybe I misunderstood your question. We have the pre-deprivation hearing in which they were complaining about her absenteeism. Primarily her refusal to work some overtime shifts, and as a disciplinary matter, they attempted to shift her to a 8-hour, 5-day-a-week shift, as allowing her to work that modified schedule where you have a heavy week and a light week. And then as she was entering into that, then she took FMLA leave, and I believe that's when they started having problems with her FMLA, and that's when they started to call that the chronic absenteeism.
Okay. I'll give you an extra minute, but I think you want to sit down now.
That's fine, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Barrow.
May it please the court. My name is Frances Barrow. I represent the Department of Correction and the Pendleton Correctional Facility.
Can I just say this? The similarities between Ms. Eaton and Mr. Curtis in terms of their refusal to accept a particular job assignment strike me as fairly compelling. There are differences, of course, in their disciplinary histories, as you have pointed out in the brief, and the district judge also pointed out, but why are those differences not something that should be weighed at trial? How can we determine, sitting here as a matter of law, that these differences were actually material to her employer?
Well, because this is one of the reasons summary judgment is useful, because this is undisputed evidence regarding her disciplinary history. For example, the excessive absences.
But why are you calling it disciplinary history when so many of the absences were fully authorized? You know, sick days because of the back problem, FMLA, vacation time. I mean, to give somebody time off and then to turn around and say, we're going to fire you for excessive absences seems odd at best, and I don't see an argument in your brief that the facility just had some places do have an absolute rule saying we don't care, you know, if the Almighty himself prevented you from coming to work. If you've missed more than X number of days, you're fired. But you haven't introduced evidence of that kind of policy.
No, what the evidence is that in, I think, August or September of 2007, she was being disciplined at that time for excessive absences. It's not until her deposition that she gives the excuse that, well, she thought these were excused absences.
Well,
the facility...
She files a grievance on September 21st, and then she comes back November 26th when she's assigned to Control Pod B, and she's put back on her original schedule. So she's, in other words, it seems that the warnings about excessive absences might have been resolved because perhaps she had an opportunity to say it was sick leave. And then that's when the FMLA period comes in. So I'm not sure. And then by December 5th, she's getting a letter of appreciation telling her to keep up the outstanding work.
The record seems to show, however, that she filed the grievance because she did not want to work the 8-hour shift. That's why she filed the grievance. The grievance ended up not going anywhere because she chose the FMLA leave. She went on leave not because of her bad back or because they were making her work in a part of a prison she didn't like. She just did not want to work a different schedule.
Well, she said it would be stressful.
Go ahead.
The employer had to authorize the FMLA leave, right?
Well, that's true, and the state is not saying there was anything wrong with her taking that leave.
Well, what's the discipline that she received for excessive absenteeism? Was that related to her use of FMLA time?
No, this was before she went on FMLA.
So she didn't get any discipline for this alleged excessive absences because she takes FMLA, which for some reason the employer approved. Maybe you approve everything when somebody says, I just like a little break from work. You know, but I find that hard to believe, actually.
Well, the record seems to show that over and over, when she and the facility get to loggerheads, that they somehow accommodate her. You know, she wants to work in the pod, so she
well,
was
they
working.
They certainly didn't accommodate her with the urine throwing incidents. He's allowed to go home and shower, and she has to stay in those woo-hoo-hoo clothes.
Okay, and
horrible.
The inference is that Curtis got to go home because he was a man and she didn't because she was a woman. And I think the reasonable inference is that you don't want a urine-soaked officer in the facility, and if it's possible for them to go home and change, you would let them do it.
A urine-soaked woman sitting
there? No, that she never said that she couldn't go to the restroom.
There's no evidence. I mean, well, going to the restroom, I don't know what your restrooms are like, but there's not probably enough to shower off and get clean clothes on.
Ooh. Well, again, the inference is that the only difference is that he was a man.
Well, that's all we have in the record, unfortunately. The state didn't introduce any evidence about distance from home. We have some sort of speculation in your brief, but there's nothing solid behind that.
Well, but again, is it a reasonable inference, though, that men get to go home and women don't?
That's the reason. The only evidence that there is there.
Yeah.
And as far as the accommodation is concerned, if you look at that letter from December of 2007, that was sent to an entire team. It was not a personal accommodation at all. She can't say that that shows that the facility thought that she personally was doing a good job.
Well, they certainly thought she was one of the people who was doing well.
Well, if there was no footnote that said...
But the problem for that argument is that this is summary judgment. We're to take the facts in the light most favorable to her. You might argue that to a jury, but it seems to me in the light most favorable to her, it's a commendation.
Well, and just to sum up, assuming she was fired, and that's what we're assuming for summary judgment, I think the correct interpretation of the events of March 8 are that this was the last straw. She was not going to mandatory training. She was not. She was refusing overtime.
I have a question about that, though. Your position is that if it went to trial, you would you might argue that she was not fired, that
correct.
She just quit. Who considered all her absences as reasons to fire her? Was this like in some kind of virtual reality or something?
Well, the record doesn't even show that. I mean, Ben Scheimer, when he says she can't come back to the facility, he indicates that that was somebody else's decision. So the record doesn't indicate who the decision makers were. I think there's a question whether she was even capable of doing the job to the extent she didn't want to walk, she didn't want to have contact with prisoners, she didn't want to work in a part of the prison where people had intimidated her. She wanted to just have a very limited role at the prison, sitting in the control pod, and when she couldn't get her way, she left in tears. And could she actually...
If that wasn't your reason, the fact that she couldn't do the job, maybe she just couldn't do the job, can we consider that that is a legitimate reason for discharging her, if it wasn't your reason?
Well, this court views the record de novo. And
so
she,
we don't make up reasons for employers. That's one reason why we see, have you actually stated a reason that's worthy, that isn't pretextual, I guess I'll say.
Right, and the legitimate...
If you make up a new one at the end of this process, by the time you're in the Court of Appeals, that actually often suggests maybe the first one was pretextual.
And again, we don't have any real... We don't have a statement. She wasn't told you're being fired because. And so looking at the evidence taken together shows that she did have a disciplinary history. At certain times, the facility took upon itself to discipline her for the absences, for not going to training, for refusing overtime. And that finally on March 8, she refuses to work on the E unit, and that was it. She just could not go on having her way, and so that was a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason, and she has not shown that that was mere pretext. And for these reasons, I'd ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Do you have anything more?
Thank you, Your Honor. Unless the court has any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. And, of course, the case will be taken under advisement. And believe it or not, we are going to the last case.